previous tentative agenda decisions, I guess previous and tentative being redundant, and Denise, I think you're taking the lead on these, at least on the first three out of four.
Hi, good morning. Agenda papers 3A, 3B, and 3C analyze the comments received on the committee's tentative agenda decisions regarding the factors affecting the identification of the acquirer, the accounting for business combinations under common control, and whether the business that is not a legal entity could be considered the acquirer in a reverse acquisition under IFRS 3. The committee analyzed and discussed these issues at the July 2011 meeting, and we received a number of comments, not very positive, by the way, on each one of these tentative agenda decisions. I would like to refer briefly to some of the aspects that we are raising in this analysis of these comment letters. So, starting with paper 3A, there was general support among the respondents that the fact pattern considered is not widespread in practice and that the committee should not take this issue onto its active agenda. There was also agreement among respondents that the tentative agenda decision should indicate that there is diversity in practice in those jurisdictions where the issue arises. However, a majority of respondents disagreed with the wording in the tentative agenda decisions, mainly because they felt that an agenda decision should not respond to issues with such level of detail, because this could lead to misinterpretations or significant changes in practice, and also because they felt that the results of the outreach, of the quick and fast outreach that we performed, were inconclusive. So all these reasons are stated in paragraph 10 of this paper. Consequently, the staff developed three alternatives that could be considered to address the respondents' concerns regarding the way agenda decisions are drafted, as explained in paragraph 11 of this paper. One alternative was to refrain from issuing a rejection note. Another one was just modifying it slightly and indicating that there is diversity in practice in some jurisdictions, such as Australia. And finally, another alternative was to refrain from providing an analysis and quoting paragraphs, etc. So as the staff pointed out in this paper, this decision is controversial. I mean, the way agenda decisions should be drafted is somehow controversial. So consequently, the staff developed two approaches, approaches A and B, that are shown in paragraphs 29 and 30 of this paper, that we think could be used as a reference framework when drafting agenda decisions, but this is to be discussed by you, obviously. So very quickly, under approach A states that where the committee thinks that the answer to an issue submitted is not clear enough or straightforward, then the committee should refrain from giving excerpts from paragraphs or stating the application of specific paragraphs in IFRSs. And then the committee should state that the transaction would be better analyzed in the context of a broader project. Under approach B, this approach states that where the answer to a particular issue is clear, straightforward, then the committee should quote and explain how relevant paragraphs in IFRSs would be applied to the issue submitted. So, for the fact pattern analyzed in paper 3A, the staff recommended the committee to conclude that the answer was too complex to be analyzed through an agenda decision or even to be addressed through an interpretation or an annual improvement. And we proposed that the committee should say that the fact pattern submitted would be better analyzed in the context of a broader project for common control transactions. For the fact pattern analyzed in paper 3B, the staff arrived to a similar conclusion and decided to refer the accounting for business combinations under common control to this same broader board project. For the fact pattern analyzed in paper 3C, the staff determined that approach B should be followed because the staff thinks that the relevant excerpts in the IFRS literature could be applied for the fact pattern analyzed in this paper. So the staff then recommended the committee to conclude that for the fact pattern submitted, a business that is not a legal entity could be considered the acquirer in a reverse acquisition. So finally, please note that the tentative agenda decisions that we are going to discuss today, during the sessions today and tomorrow, do not necessarily follow this logic that we developed for approach A and approach B. Let me tell you why. Because first, we would like to hear your views first on these approaches that we have developed. And also because some of those papers that you're going to see in the sessions today and tomorrow were written before we developed these approaches. So we would like to welcome your views on the tentative agenda decisions that we have drafted in papers 3A, 3B, and 3C, and subsequently Thomas will give his presentation on paper 3D.
Margaret, you're up first.
Well, I wanted to commend the staff for taking the initiative to come up with a framework for responding to this issue at hand and making it very broad. I think the approaches that you outline are very good, and I think it's a very good step. It eliminated a little confusion because this is something that you hear about from people that have to implement what we pronounce, and that it will be nice to have more consistency into our approach in addressing those. So thank you very much. In terms of the revised wording in the agenda decisions, I would agree with what you've proposed.
Okay. Ruth, I have you up next.
I don't object to the two approaches that have been developed, but I don't agree with the process with which they've been developed. In other words, I think that what you've come up with is a good starting point for us to look at as part of the effectiveness review and probably should be discussed tomorrow with the board. I don't think that this is the right place to deal with it. And to suddenly decide, yep, that's what we're going to do and that's what we're going to implement from now on. So it may be the right way forward. I have a few issues with some of them, but I don't think this is the appropriate place to discuss it. And I think the effectiveness review is the appropriate place. In terms of the wording of the agenda decisions on, I think it's both on 3A and 3B, there's a statement in there that the issue is too complex to be resolved by an annual improvement or an interpretation. Right. And I think that's a bit damning on the Interpretations Committee. If we think something is too complex to be addressed by an interpretation, we just spent the whole morning dealing with something pretty complex, and we think we probably could reach an interpretation on it. So I don't think we should say in an agenda decision that the issue is too complex to be dealt with in an interpretation. I'm happy for us to say it's too complex to be dealt with in an annual improvement, because annual improvements aren't supposed to deal with complex issues. But I really strongly disagree with saying too complex to be dealt with in an interpretation.
Sarah, I think you're next. If you could push the button and let me know where I need to be looking. Okay.
I fully agree with what Ruth said in terms of the process, because I really would like to talk about approaches A and B more fully, particularly B, which seems to me to be a quasi-interpretation in and of itself. But that's for another discussion. I also agree with Ruth's comment on the wording for papers 3A and 3B. I found that complex was not maybe the word we wanted to use. I think the word we wanted to use was broad, that this issue was broad and it needed to be addressed in the context of common control transactions, as opposed to, yeah, that's a complex topic, but it's a topic that's broader than where we have a standard with which to deal with the topic now. So I really think our reason for referring this to the board is this is a broad issue that the board needs to address, and there may be interpretations necessary around that at a later date, but right now we don't have anything on which to base an interpretation because the board needs to give us a standard with which to work. So I think you could pretty much solve the, it, from my perspective, the wording challenge by just taking out the word complex and put broad. And
back in the day, I remember a FASB practice fellow who began his two-year term working on this kind of issue, and to the best of my knowledge, never worked on anything else for the entire 2 years he was there. And I shudder to think of inflicting that on any of our staff. I think Joanna, Guido, Laurence, Andrew.
First of all, in terms of the broad approach of, if you like, and I don't mean it in a nasty way at all, but dumbing down these tentative decisions, I think is absolutely appropriate. I think that we tried, we thought we were doing the right thing, but I think where we've got to in terms of not giving the specific fact pattern in A and B are absolutely the correct thing. Now, whether it is too complex or broad or whatever, I haven't focused on the wording, so perhaps, you know, looking at that. But in terms of the concept, I think it's right. I also totally agree that, yep, it was a good starting point in terms of doing your approach A and approach B, but it is absolutely a starting point, and to me is the crux of the, if you like, the issue of part of the effectiveness review as to what the hell do we write in our decisions. The final comment that I think I would just like to make, I think that, and it relates to the diversity and the fact that Australia keeps coming up here, in that my, if you like, outreach in Australia and New Zealand, that part of the issue here is, in fact, what I articulated at the last meeting but wasn't strong enough, is that Australians and New Zealanders actually think that 2A and 2B were very, very similar, and therefore the issue with 2A is that the Australians disagreed with the conclusion. Yeah. As opposed to there is diversity. I think it is within Australia, you know, 5 out of 6 firms, or just about every man and his dog, and that includes me in New Zealand, thought that that was the right answer. So just to clarify that for others here, that it isn't so much that there is diversity in Australia, it's actually that Australia did not agree with the... And it's great, it brought it to a head in terms of, if you like, your approach A and B. But I just wanted to get that on the table, if you like, because that's certainly the feedback that I've had from those. But support where you're at with both all three, 3A, B, and C.
Ruth, you wanted to come right back on that.
Just on the Australian situation, I think the regulatory environment in Australia is quite different in that acquisition accounting has existed for a long, long time, and the pooling of interest method was never applied. And so historically, acquisition accounting would be applied in the event of a new code being created all the time, just as a matter of course. So the Australian regulator has historically, even after the move to IFRS, been in favour of acquisition accounting, which is why this issue became so controversial. And in most cases would try to get to the answer of applying acquisition accounting because they believe that that was the appropriate accounting. So I think we just need to understand the background. It's an environment where pooling was not used and is still not commonly used.
Guido, I think you're up next.
We'll come to these two approaches, A and B. I think it's a good idea to think about it, although, just to give you one example, I think we need to spend more time on thinking about it, because if you look at paragraph 29, which deals with approach A, it says that it involves reasonable degree of judgment even if sufficient guidance is present in IFRS. If there is sufficient guidance in IFRS, then the answer should be clear. Now, applying that to 3A, I think, looking at the arguments that were brought forward in the comment letters, they don't really, I don't think that those are real arguments. I mean, it could lead to significant changes in practice. Well, if practice was wrong and we think it's the right answer, then is that an argument? It could be a de facto interpretation. I don't think that this is an argument. Some references used are not relevant. Well, then just change the references and then it's fine. I think the only argument that applies to 3A and B is that people might apply those answers that we gave them to similar situations. Now, I could say I don't see that danger because the wording says specifically in this specific fact pattern, this is the answer. Now, I know that people like to strike out those words and apply it by analogy. So that would be for me the only reason to go to a more simplistic wording. But I think still think 3A, we got the right answer, and 3B, if you look at the guidance. Especially when you look to 3B, I think one of the arguments was, at the end of the day, it's a reverse acquisition and you don't have a business combination at all. So then just let's change it and don't say it's a business combination under common control, it's a transaction under common control. Because you have the same problem under IFRS 3 if it's not a common control transaction. If a NewCo acquires another company, NewCo and the other company were not under common control, you may end up in a reverse acquisition, and it might not be a business combination then. So I don't think that that's a good argument. But anyway, I understand that 3A and B, people may apply that by analogy, and that might be the reason why we restrict ourselves, but all the other arguments I don't really see.
Laurence, I have you next on the list.
Yes, I was not present at the discussion at the July meeting, unfortunately, so I couldn't give views on this. I must say that personally I was agreeing with the outcome of what was proposed in the tentative conclusions. Although I did read the comment letters and understand some of the concerns that have been expressed. I do believe that the wording for 3A and 3B needs reworking. I completely agree that we should not use the reason that it's too complex. We are failing our mandate if we go down that route. We don't reject issues because they are too complex. So I agree with the fact that it's too broad. I see also that in the rejection it is proposed, it says too complex to be analyzed through an agenda decision. What is the purpose of agenda decision? Is it to analyze situations? No, it is not. So I would not use that wording to say decisions, agenda decisions, analyze fact patterns and so on. And this leads me to the comments we have received, where people sometimes were not criticizing the outcome or the accounting answer that was given through those tentative decisions, but were criticizing the process or the means that were used to provide clarity on the treatment, with the fact that agenda decisions are considered to be non-authoritative literature, but some do consider it as providing kind of literature you cannot avoid, and in which case, for those who had been applying previous treatment, they would have to restate. And to restate retrospectively those types of transactions is very, very difficult. So the concern was not so much on the outcome the tentative decision was leading to. The concern was more on how do you implement this outcome when this was not your previous accounting policies. And I do believe that this is an issue that we will have to discuss later on tomorrow about the status of agenda decisions. Thirdly, you do refer, particularly in 3A, to say that this fact pattern is not widespread in many jurisdictions, and we just talk about Australia. No, I've seen it myself. In Europe, I've seen it in Brazil. So I'm not so sure that we can say it's not widespread in many jurisdictions. It is widespread. We know that those types of transactions take place, and when they take place, I can tell you that the amounts are big, usually. So I think we need to revise the conclusions for not adding those issues onto our agenda. And I my initial reactions when I read it in July was that the first paragraph for Agenda Paper 3A in the rejection that was presented has been condensed so much that effectively, is it really dealing with the fact pattern only, or can it be analogized? And that's why I agree with some of the concerns that have been expressed that analogies would be made to lead to a conclusion with which I would have agreed looking at the previous papers, but maybe too much summarized. So that's for Agenda Paper 3A. Agenda Paper 3B, I have the same concern about when we say to be analyzed through an agenda decision. And I don't know if we are going to discuss Agenda Paper 3C, because I think that the category of Agenda Paper 3C is a little bit different from 3A and 3B, in the sense that I think that for this one, the answer is clearer, that effectively you don't need a legal wrap-up to identify a reporting entity or to make it an acquirer. So we refer to the current framework. We don't highlight what's the reference in the current framework to explain to the people. We say, therefore, the committee thinks that an acquirer that is a reporting entity but not a legal entity can be considered to be the acquirer in reverse acquisition. Do we want to provide that clarity? Here, aren't we de facto providing an interpretation, raising again that question about if we do so for those who had not applied those policies, what do they do? Do they restate retrospectively? The committee noted that this issue is not widespread. Again, I disagree that it is not widespread. So what on Agenda 3C, Agenda Paper 3C, what are the real reasons why we are not adding this issue on our agenda? I think that the reason is that we believe the answer is clear and that we don't expect diversity in practice. But can we say so? So I think that we need to explore better the reasons why we are not adding this issue on our agenda.
I just want to clarify, you say that these issues are widespread, and is that drawing on your own experience of seeing these? Because obviously the responses that we had received when we did the outreach suggested otherwise.
My experience, my environment. It's not just limited to one jurisdiction. Then what do you mean widespread? Okay, what's the prevalence? Okay, I know that in the ISB's consultation by its work program, it lists some criteria, importance, prevalence, and so on and so on. I think that these are types of criteria we need also to discuss. What does it mean widespread? I can say I have seen each of those cases personally in the past.
Andrew?
Well, I don't think we have seen those, or I'm talking about 3A anyway, those cases very often at all. I don't think we had the right answer last time for the reasons we discussed. I don't think there's a business combination here. I think NewCos are inextricably linked with common control subject, and therefore I think the direction of the revised agenda decision is entirely appropriate. I don't mind changing words like complex for broad. I'm happy with that. The only comment I had on the agenda decision was just in terms of the flow of it. The penultimate paragraph says, we've learned there's significant diversity in practice and we decided not to add it to its agenda, which kind of reads somewhat oddly. I would have thought if there's any comment about significant diversity in practice in one jurisdiction or whatever, that should be sort of built into the higher up the agenda decision to make things flow better. But I fully support the direction of the agenda decision.
Scott, I think you're next.
With respect to the approaches, I think I agree with what others have said. In general, they seem reasonable, but we need more time to think about and discuss them in a situation where we're not dealing with a particular issue. It's a broader thing to discuss. I agree with most of what's been said about the use of the words too complex and what have you in the agenda decisions. I'm not aware that we decided these things were too hard for us. We just thought that they were better as part of the board's common control project. If the board came to us and said, we would like you to do the common control project, would we then go back and say, oh, no, that's too hard for us. You need to do that. No, I think we'd tackle it and see what we could do. So I don't like the words too complex. Regarding the three agenda decisions, I actually thought we had the right answers originally. 3A is not a common control transaction. 3B is a common control transaction. 3C, yes, a non-legal entity can be the acquirer. It certainly seems like there is significant difference of opinion regarding whether 3A is a common control transaction or not. So I think we have to change that opinion because I hear around the table that we don't all agree that isn't a common control transaction. 3B, my sense is that we all agree that's a common control transaction. Mm-hmm. We just don't know how to account for common control transactions. I'd like to be clear in the agenda decision that we do think this is a common control transaction, and that's why we don't know what to do, because there's no guidance in IFRS with respect to common control transactions. And I also agree with the agenda decision on 3C. I think the answer to that is clear regarding the concerns. You know, what if somebody hasn't been doing that? I guess they've been doing it wrong. I mean, I don't. Sometimes we get asked questions and we think the literature is clear and we should say so. And if somebody's been doing something else, then, you know, I think they've got to deal with that with their regulator, with their auditors, with their board of directors, and what have you. But we can't not take on an issue or not express, excuse me, we can't not express the view that the answer is clear just because we know there are some companies that have done something else. So that would indicate that any question that comes to us, we could never say the answer is clear, because the fact that it's come to us means that somebody thinks that there's multiple answers.
Ruth. Excuse me, Ruth.
Yes, just picking up on what Guido had said, and I think what Scott had said as well, my personal view is that we did arrive at the correct answer in respect of 3A and 3B and 3C. 3C is not so controversial. I think the issue is that the fact pattern in 3A had to be so very narrowly defined and the answer had to be so very clearly spelt out to explain why we got to that answer, which may have been the cause for concern. But I agree with Guido that in that specific fact pattern, and for the specific reasons that we gave, that we agreed that that was the answer. Certainly a majority of us did. Now, the fact that some people don't like the answer, is that a reason for us to change the decision? I mean, and that's a serious question to this body and possibly tomorrow's question to the board. You know, are we here? Yes, we're here to help people, but are we here to always give them the answer they want? Or are we here to give them the answer that we think is the correct interpretation of IFRS? So if the result of our discussion is that it's not the answer that they want, will that always lead us to approach A, which is it's going to be unpopular, therefore we'll say nothing or we'll do nothing? And I think we need to think hard about that tomorrow in our discussion with the board. And that's what worries me about what we've done on A and B, probably less so on B because I think we were quite unanimous on B. The debate really is whether or not it's a business combination or not, and I think the amended wording would be fine. But I actually think on A and B, the way we've reworded the agenda decision to effectively say nothing, I don't think we're fulfilling our purpose as an interpretations committee.
Ruth, are you concerned? Guido raised a point that personally I found pretty important in my thinking about it, and that was the risk of extensive analogy. Are you concerned about that one on these, that these will be the new 3% rules?
I'm not concerned about the use by analogy as long as we very clearly define the fact pattern and the reasons why in that specific fact pattern, for these very specific reasons, we reached that conclusion, which is what we did on 3A. It was very narrow, and it was quite hotly debated. It wasn't an easy decision, but it was where we got to. And it was very narrow. And I think the concern that you see coming back in the letters is that that could be drawn out by analogy to other circumstances, mm-hmm. and that's why there was some concern.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. To me, that's not a reason to completely withdraw the agenda decision and say, sorry, we can't deal with it, because it might be interpreted too broadly. I think that would cause us rather to further narrow it and make it a very, very narrow analysis. That's the way I would have gone. So I wouldn't have gone with the approach A. I would have gone with making it very, very narrowly defined so as to avoid the concern about application by analogy.
Jean?
I also thought that agenda decision 3A, I thought we had the right answer, but I also agree to revert back to what's proposed there, subject to the comments that were made on too complex and all that. And it's, I think I'd like to make my comments in view of approach A and B. So we switched from approach B to approach A, basically. We have a quasi-interpretation in approach B, and we have a quasi-due process, because that's an example where we receive numerous comments on a rejection, and then we change as a result of comments that we've received. It's not a full due process, but it's a quasi-due process, so we're in the quasi-field. Based on what I've discussed with users and the people that are concerned with these type of decisions, their concern is not so much that we lack the due diligence or that we come up with answers that are wrong. It's their concern is the fact that whether it's authoritative or not is one issue. Some regulators will make it authoritative, and some auditors will make it authoritative. So this is this kind of uncertainty about what it is. Also the lack of transition, because when we issue that kind of rejection, there are diversity in practice usually. And that whether we say, well, the answer is clear, it's easy to say the answer is clear, but there's diversity of practice out there. And therefore, we change the practice for many in some situation. Therefore, there is no transition rules. They dislike that. So it's a correction of an error, because that will result in the correction of an error. The other criticisms that I've heard is the lack of codification of this these quasi-opinion or interpretation. So all of that to say that I agree with the revision to 3A, because I believe that if there is, you mentioned Roots, that it's because they don't like the answer, and that's maybe true, but it's I think it's too easy to say that. I think there have been expression of divergence of opinion, and we didn't go through a full due process. And therefore, if we want to do that, we need to go through a full due process and issue an interpretation on the narrow situation. On the issue of approach A and B, I think I will conclude on that. I think if we want to stick to approach B,
which is very efficient, I think, and it's probably what the people want, absent the fact that they don't like the answer. They want to have guidance. They want to have more guidance. So approach B would be okay, but I wonder if we should explore ways to make it more concrete and more codified and whatever. So that's my comment.
Fei Long, I have you next.
I agree with the staff proposal approach A and refrain from giving guidance on the on this piecemeal and narrow issue, and have the same concern about the wording too complex, as other members said. One more thing is that also related to wording. And in paragraph 15, it states the diversity in practice, and but I don't understand how adding words significant diversity wording will achieve a reduction of diversity in practice after issuing the revised agenda decision.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Andrew, Joanna, Sarah.
Just on one very technical matter, I don't know if people have noticed these lights keep going out automatically this time. I don't know if the technology has changed, but
that's why I have this fallback.
Sorry, just on paper 3A, I don't think, I honestly don't think it's a question of not wishing to go there because people don't like the answer. I think it's a question of getting the appropriate answer and the risk of opening the discussion we had last time. You know, the whole transaction's been organised by the seller, and I don't see why you get step-up accounting just because you add a paper-thin UCO around the transaction. If you spin off a subsidiary without a UCO and just do an IPO of a subsidiary, you don't get step-up accounting in that subsidiary. So why should you, in a situation where you just add a paper-thin wrapper around it? That was last time's discussion, but I honestly don't think it's a question of not getting to an answer people don't want. I think it's a question of getting to the right answer.
On a similar line,
and I guess the first thing I would say is I absolutely agree with Ruth that we should not be backing down because people don't like the answer. And I think that we need to be very clear about that, that we don't do that. I do not believe that that is the case in this example. I think that, and in fact, the PwC letter, I think, actually sets it out quite well, where it makes the comment that actually it's a very, like the specific fact pattern, it's very, very hard, however narrow you try to make it, within an agenda decision, for everybody to have all of the information and they can analogize it to their situation and say it is the same fact pattern when, in fact, the debate that we've had that's taken 3 hours but is then ended up in one little paragraph doesn't give it. Therefore, I actually think that our going to the more general is because it is so hard, whether or not it is right, to actually do it for such a very, very narrow fact pattern. So I think we are absolutely doing the right thing by backing down from that specific thing, but it is not, and I'm very firm of the view, it is not because others have said they disagree, and therefore we're backing down for that reason. It is because it is so hard to actually put it into words, and the whole common control issue is a much broader issue.
Sarah?
I was fixing to say that I had totally agreed with what Jean was saying, and then he started talking about view B, and I kind of don't agree with that. And my point is, if we look at the agenda decision in 3C, we did agree that an entity need not be a legal entity to be the acquirer. Got it. But when we issue an agenda decision like this, it becomes de facto IFRS. So if you were doing something different, your auditor could say that's an error and whoops, you've got possibly a restatement. And maybe it was an error. Maybe you were messing up. But we've kind of done this in a roundabout manner that didn't go through the whole process. And I'm sympathetic with what Jean was saying, that preparers are, that's a concern. How do you, there aren't transitions, there isn't a full due process. So these kinds of agenda decisions sort of behave like those nasty little FSPs we had from the FASB for a while, that you kind of got hit with something without it going through the whole process. So I'm concerned about approach B, because I think we end up doing de facto quasi-interpretations that we pretend aren't official, but they kind of are. But that's a discussion for effectiveness also.
And one of the things I was about to say is we're kind of tap dancing along the line here, but
right.
Are you troubled by the alternative that this committee becomes the place where one gets forgiveness? So all you have to do is to bring an issue, and that means that despite the fact that 75 out of 80 people who've looked at it say you're crazy, you can get forgiveness, dispensation. And so that would suggest that we always have to take the approach that it was a reasonable position. My concern is that you're worried about everything being significant things being characterized as correction of an error.
Correct.
And the opposite is that a lot of things wind up coming here because people know that once it gets through that door, there's instant dispensation. It can't have been an error. You can't have been wrong if you got through the door and this committee talked about it, which would say no retroactive application.
Okay, so my life's all about forgiveness, so I'm okay with that. And having been a preparer like forever, I think that we didn't intentionally do things wrong.
Understood.
And so we may have gone through a fairly thorough analysis to come to the conclusion that we did, only to find out that our auditors or the Interpretations Committee disagreed with us. So I'm more likely to be on the dispensation forgiveness side, but that's being just how I was a preparer. So, but y'all may not be there.
I'm not sure which of those is the right one. I've seen both.
Right.
I think all of us have seen some pretty sleazy behavior on occasion.
But not by preparers, ever.
Okay. That's a technical term, by the way, sleazy. But Guido, I think you're next, and then Scott.
Two quick observations, one on 3A and 3B. 3A, sorry, Andrew, but this argument that if you just put another company in between and not selling the shares to your shareholders, well, if you sell them directly to your shareholders, you don't have a reporting entity. That's if you have a NewCo there that buys the shares, the NewCo prepares the financial statements. You have to think about how those statements are prepared. So I don't think that's an argument. I am in the camp of Ruth. I think if we describe the fact pattern very narrowly, then it should have been there. But I see also that a lot of people have problems with that. So I'm fine with 3A in this respect. For 3B, I'm in Scott's camp. Everybody seems to agree this is a common control transaction. Why not say it? There's no diversity around here. There doesn't seem to be anybody has a problem with these answers, so why not stick in 3B with a clear answer?
Scott, and then Ruth.
Yeah, mostly I was just in response to Sarah's concern. I think that, you know, number one, yes, we've seen sleazy behavior. I mean, I've been at EITF meetings where it was pretty clear that an issue was sent to the EITF to get transition. Everybody knew what the answer was, but they didn't want to have to restate. So they sent it to the EITF in the hopes of getting transition, and sometimes they succeeded and sometimes they failed. But I don't want to be in the position of, you know, ask us a question and we'll tell you how to transition to the right answer. If there's one right answer, then, well, we ought to say so, and if it's an error, it's an error. I think some of the some of the issue is that we seem to be unable to treat errors as simply honest mistakes made by well-intentioned people who just made a mistake. And we seem to be in the mindset that, you know, a restatement means you were bad. You're an evil person. You are a company that was trying to deceive. And I don't think that's the case. Sometimes errors are just errors, and we ought not refrain from saying there's only one answer just to give dispensation. And I don't think we should have to go through the full interpretation process in order to say that. So I'm comfortable with the approach B in general as laid out when we do think that the answer is clear.
Ruth and Andrew, and then we'll try and see if we can come to a conclusion.
Just a 3 points. One, on 3A, except where we've got to. I still think we have the right answer, but I can accept that given the diversity, et cetera, I could live with the agenda decision as long as we replace complex with broad or something else. On this issue of transition, this has been an issue ever since the SIC and the IFRIC were created and has never been resolved. So ever since rejection notices and agenda decisions have been out there, this issue of what to do has been out there and has never been addressed. So I think it needs to be addressed again as part of the effectiveness review. I think in practice, auditors, in my experience, have never enforced retrospective application as a result of a change in practice. They've said, IFRIC has clarified something, you need to go forward and change it from now on. That's been my experience of it, if that's been the case. So I think the concern about transition is a valid one, and something needs to be done about it in terms of the charter and the status of agenda decisions, and that's for tomorrow's discussion. In respect of 3B, I think we could go back to our original wording and perhaps just make it clear that this was a transaction under common control rather than a business combination under common control, and I think that would take away the problem. And the last thing is on 3C, we've added in a reference to an exposure draft, and I don't think we should do that in agenda decisions because that is only an exposure draft, and who's to say if that's how it will eventuate. So I don't think we should reference a decision to an exposure draft.
Andrew?
Just on 3B, I mean, the way I read 3B as currently drafted was that it was acknowledging we were dealing with something under common control. I mean, the opening sentence talks about requests for guidance on accounting for business combinations under common control. The second sentence says, more specifically, the submission describes a fact pattern that illustrates a type of common control transaction. And then in the main sort of middle paragraph, it says, the committee observed that the accounting for a fact pattern involving a common control transaction. So I thought the whole thrust of this was we are talking about a common control transaction, we just don't know how to account for it.
Mm-hmm. And also, just connect with that, I think the disagreement in the comment letters was not whether it's a common control transaction, but whether it's a common control business combination, and that's the amendment that we've made.
So just leave it.
No. Okay, I see with three issues, four possibilities. One is, and I hope that this is going to get shouted down, that we defer any agenda decisions until we've come to a better understanding of the effectiveness review. Okay. Although some of the comments that I heard in the discussion might have led me that way. I was hoping you'd say that. Okay. Then, looking at the three issues, let me propose. I heard a variety of rationales on 3A, but I didn't hear, with the maybe one or two exceptions, anyone objecting to the general place where it wound up. There are lots of editorial stuff, and change complex to broad and things. Am I correct in my understanding that for whatever reason, people are satisfied with where 3A winds up? Pardon me? I'm sorry, Lawrence, can you use your mic here?
is to leave diversity.
To leave to omit?
3A.
To remain.
Well, if diversity remain. Existed before and we don't do anything, yeah, it will remain.
That's the outcome.
Yeah. Okay, I don't see any objections, so we'll take that one, subject to massive editorial comments that I think we should do offline. But I heard an awful lot of editorial stuff. 3B, again, I thought I heard general agreement with the direction that it went, changing the discussion from common control business combination to common control transaction. Any objections on that one? And 3C, again, any objections? I thought that one we had pretty widespread agreement both on the substance and the form. Okay, the other thing that we talked about a lot and that I think we definitely have to take on board, Denise has done some, I think, very creative thinking in trying to give us a framework for analyzing how we do these things. I take absolutely the people's comments that we probably need to discuss that in a broader context as part of the effectiveness review, but she certainly helped me think about it. And I think we owe her some thanks for that. It was good staff work. Thomas, then, having teed that up.
Thank you, Wayne. Issue 3D. It's also a review of a tentative agenda decision from the July 2011 meeting. The committee received a request seeking clarification on how entities that are established as new intermediate parents within a group determine cost of their investment in subsidiaries when they account for these investments in their separate financial statements at cost in accordance with IAS 27. The request addresses reorganizations of group when the reorganization results in the new intermediate parent having more than one subsidiary. The committee discussed the issue at its meeting in July, and it made a tentative agenda decision not to take the issue onto its agenda. Since then, we have received two comment letters with respect to the tentative agenda decision, and both letters supported the decision not to take the issue to the committee's agenda. One of these letters provides additional comments that we analyze in the following. The other comment letter, in contrast, not only supports the decision not to take the issue onto the agenda, but also agrees with the technical analysis and the conclusion. The other comment letter instead expresses concerns that although the committee tentatively decided not to take the issue to the agenda, that the tentative agenda decision nevertheless provides guidance on the accounting for certain types of reorganization. The constituents thinks that such agenda decision should be restricted to referring to IFRS literature, that the committee thinks should be considered, and to explaining which of the agenda criteria is not met. We agree with the constituents that an agenda decision by the committee should explain which agenda criteria were not met when the committee decides not to take an issue onto its agenda, and that the wording of the tentative agenda decision published in the July 2011 IFRIC update on this issue could be improved. However, the committee decided not to take the issue onto its agenda because it thought that this the agenda criterion that is not met is that because there is sufficient guidance on this issue in IAS 27, and so there is no issue that needs to be resolved because the standard is clear. if we answer to a particular issue, that is clear, and the conclusion can be drawn from the application of the relevant IVRSs without the need for significant level of judgment, we think that the committee should quote the main excerpts in the IVRS literature that were considered in the analysis of this issue, explain how the committee thinks the relevant paragraphs apply to that fact pattern submitted, and give the reason why the agenda criteria were not met. This is the approach B presented by Denise. Consequently, we agree with the constituents that reference to paragraph BC66Q of IS-27 amended 2008 and paragraph BC27 of IS-27 revised 2011 should be added to the agenda decision. But we are not convinced that the last two sentences in the second paragraph of the tentative agenda decision published in the July 2011 IFRIC update should be removed. In these sentences, the committee is explaining how the relevant excerpts of the standard should be applied. We recommend that the committee should confirm that it will not take the issue onto its agenda and that it should proceed with the agenda decision, but with the amendments that we proposed in Appendix A to the agenda paper. So the question I would like to ask to the committee is, does the committee agree with our recommendation? Florence?
Yeah, I was discussing with Thomas. It is unfortunate because my organization sent a comment letter, but you didn't have it. You got lost for some reason I have not found out yet. The letter was expressing disagreement with where you were going.
No.
But anyway, looking at agenda paper 3D, I disagree with what is being said and the arguments for rejecting the arguments used to reject addition to the agenda and the wording. To be clear, I agree it should not be added to the agenda. But here, the fact is, what does IS-27 says? IS-27 says permits the measurement of costs in a certain way in a specified fact pattern. The fact pattern that was submitted is different from the one that is being addressed in IS-27. The basis for conclusion of IS-27 says that the board did not consider the fact patterns other than the one that has been addressed in IS-27. As a result, entities should continue with their accounting policies. What does it mean to continue with their accounting policies? We know that on this type of subject, which is another case of accounting for a transaction between under common control, the issue of determining costs has not been, or there is diversity on how do you determine costs in that situation. Is it historical costs, is it fair value, and so on. I'm afraid that the rejection as it is being written and how it is phrased, the latest draft, will drive constituents to a fair value measurement only and will not be able to use the historical costs in measuring the cost of those investments in the fact pattern considered. This is because when you look at the first paragraph of the agenda rejection, it says the committee received a request for addressing clarification on how entities determine the cost of their investment. Second paragraph says, okay, you cannot apply paragraph 38B and C of IS-27, which is correct to this fact pattern. And then you have the third paragraph which says, as a result, the committee noted that there is already sufficient guidance in IS-27. No, there is not sufficient guidance in IS-27 because for the fact pattern presented in the submission, the board refused to consider it. So you don't have guidance in IS-27. The only thing you have in IS-27 is clarification that you cannot apply the requirements in paragraph 38B and C. But IS 27 doesn't tell you how to measure costs for the transactions that have been submitted.
I have to say that on my paper here, I have written the comment, so what can you do?
Exactly.
One of the concerns was that we have kind of a litany here of all the thou shalt nots, but it's not obvious what the thou shalt is. So I take your point. Others? Lito?
I'm not very... We don't prepare separate financial statements under IFRS in Germany, so I haven't seen that issue before. But I thought that 838 and the other paragraphs tell you that normally, and then you have guidance, you would apply fair value accounting. So if you acquire such, if you are within such a reorganization, it would be fair value, with one exception, which is laid down in paragraph 38B, I think. And we don't have that exception here, so apply the general rule. That would be my understanding. So you have a rule in 27.
True.
That's what we agreed at the meeting, that this was an exception to the normal rule, and it was a very clear exception, and the board hadn't intended to extend it. And it applies to determining cost in the separate financial statements where IFRS is used. I thought we got there reasonably quickly. I wouldn't like to see us reopen this debate.
Laurent, you want to come back?
Yes, because in that case, if the committee in full agreement believes that the measurement of costs in such a transaction should only be fair value, then it should be clearer. But then it should have been exposed as well. Because I can tell you at the moment it is misleading, the outcome. So agree you cannot apply 38B and C and measure at the equity amount in the parents' accounts. But I mean it is a transaction between entities under common control, and I have seen in practice that the shares are measured at the historical shares. The historical costs as presented in the parents' financial statements. They are not stepped up. And I think that the rejection, that afternoon while I was not present. So when you discussed it in July, so I could not make my points there.
We discussed was that this whole issue of transaction entities under common control applies to consolidated financial statements. And here we're talking about the separate financial statements, and those separate financial statements are showing a very different picture from the consolidated financial statements. And that, in our view, was why the board said this is a very limited exception, because it actually isn't a transaction under common control. It's not consolidated financial statements. These are the separate financial statements which account for the investment in the subsidiary, as opposed to bringing through the assets and liabilities.
Andrew?
Well, I do think I agree with Laurence that if you're going to slip in the words fair value in this agenda decision, then some further due process would be warranted, because, I mean, I haven't got the standard in front of me, but I think, as a matter of fact, people are not always using fair value in these circumstances. So, to me, that's a step that would require further research. I'm not saying it's the wrong answer. I'm just saying, just slipping in a final agenda decision without having been in a tentative agenda decision where it could create issues.
Point well taken. Joanna?
I guess I was just coming back to the point that Ruth made, in that I guess these are just, you're buying an investment, end of story, whether it happens to be, if you like, the 27 is absolutely an exception in relation to
a very particular circumstance. Anything other than that, the fact that it happens to be in the same group in the individual financial statements is completely and utterly irrelevant. And therefore, where we got to and the words, whether you slip in fair value, it is simply you follow the normal rules about an acquisition of an investment. Of an acquisition of an asset. And so it's, yes, cost is what you, yes, how you determine cost, end of story. And if people, and I guess if people are doing it a different way, then, yeah.
So issue shares, so you would issue, you would measure fair value. Now, if the intermediary sub buys it for 1 euro, you recognize it at 1 euro, even if the fair value is different? Not sure I understand the logic.
But we did have that discussion.
Yeah, but the issue is, if you did that with any related party transaction, how would you account for it? If the fact that it is part of a group is not relevant, because these are the individual financial statements that we're talking about. And so if it and it could be a contribution from your shareholder, arguably, I mean, how you deal with it, but it is your normal transaction of acquiring an asset by issuing shares or whatever you pay for it. How would you account for that in a normal circumstance? That's where we, that's the conclusion that we reach. Now, whether that very clearly says this in here or whether we go round and round in circles without actually explicitly saying that, I don't know.
Yeah, because the first paragraph of the rejection doesn't address the case. It's mixing everything. It's mixing when you're issuing shares, when you're issuing cash, as far as I read it. Because even between transaction between entities in the group, when you do it on a cash transaction, you record it for the cash amount.
Right.
Not fair value.
But we don't say fair value.
We never say fair value. We say cost.
And it's what other standards tell you to do when you acquire an asset. That's the key.
Scott and then Andrew.
I was just going to say, I mean, we this is the discussion we had last time around, and we discussed, you know, hey, you know, it's all with under common control, so you could either have subsidiary issue shares to acquire the other, you know, the other subsidiaries, or parent could form new subsidiary, contribute 100 euro in cash, and then pay 100 euro for the other subsidiaries. And G, that's non-substantive, but you're going to get to a different answer, because if they issue shares, you're going to record it at the fair value of shares. If they just issue 100 euro in cash, you're going to record it at 100 euro, and G isn't that bad. I think we all kind of agreed, yeah, that doesn't feel good, but IAS 27 says cost. So the issue that we're really dealing with is, when can you use somebody else's cost rather than your cost? And we have an exception that says, in this case, you can use somebody else's cost, that is the parent's cost. But we don't have that case, and so we don't meet the exception, and so you got to use your cost. That's the discussion we had. Now, frankly, I prefer that in common control transactions, you always use the cost to the group. But that's not what IAS 27 says. Well, you don't have a group here, right? I think it's awfully odd, but that's what IAS 27 says, and so I think that's where we came out. I mean, and you know, it's exactly what we discussed last time, and you know, we said, consistent with the separate financial statement guidance, that's your answer.
Andrew?
My recollection of the thrust of the discussion last time was very much whether this exception applied or not, not what the sort of other half of the equation is, if this doesn't apply, what should apply. So I go back to the comment I made about slipping in the words fair value. I mean, what is cost is not necessarily that easy. I mean, we've had discussions, on
contingent pricing on assets. We can't work out what cost is in those circumstances. So at the moment, well, that's work in progress. But I really do think if we're going to, and I'm not quite sure now whether we are intending slipping in the words fair value or not.
No.
Okay, well, fine. If that's fine.
Okay, may I make a proposal to the House then? I thought Scott, at least for me, punched through the barrier of saying the issue here is between when do you use cost, governed by whatever standard governs the particular transaction, and when do you use somebody else's cost. It would help me a lot to understand what this agenda notice was actually rejecting if we could work that analysis into it. Because I think there is disagreement around the room about anything else about it, about whether it means fair value of consideration or whatever else cost might mean in some circumstances. I don't think I see here agreement around the room about that point. So may I propose that we ask Thomas to go back and rework the decision subject to editorial review, but I hope not the need for review at another committee meeting. So it's more a matter of reorganizing it to make clear that it's not implying a fair value answer, and to make clear that its cost is governed by whatever literature happens to govern it for that transaction. And also that, by the way, you can't use somebody else's cost unless you meet these specific requirements of these exceptions. Is that acceptable to the group?
Going beyond what we discussed. We were asked a simple question, which was whether the exemption could be applied by analogy. That's all we were asked. And we answered that question, which was no, it can't be applied by analogy. We spoke about the problems that have been alluded to with related party transactions and the fact that in a related party transaction, your €1 example might be what's used. We didn't go into whether you needed to account for a contribution by a parent, because the whole issue of accounting for related party transactions is a separate and fraught issue, and we didn't want to address that. And so my recommendation would be we don't do anything more than what we've done, which is answer the question, which is, can we apply the exemption by analogy? And our answer was no, and we leave it at that. I think if we try and say more or do more, we just make it even more complicated.
Well, and I would certainly associate myself with that, but for the fact that that's not the question that's asked in the rejection notice. The phrasing of the question in the rejection notice is what is cost.
Yeah.
Not what exceptions apply.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and I was told that the original submission was phrased in terms of what is cost, not necessarily the exceptions. So if I'm mistaken in that, then we can solve it that way by simply saying, can you use the exceptions? The answer is no. But I was told that it was a broader issue.
My
We can check that over the lunch break, report back to you this afternoon just to clarify this particular question,
yeah,
and then work out which bit we revise as a consequence.
I think that's a good plan. That's a good plan. A motion to adjourn then is always in order, and it's lunchtime. May I suggest we reconvene at 2 o'clock? Okay.